And I just want to say from your last week's episode, as you had Kyle and Ari in, and they may be more humorous, they may be more funny, but they are definitely sports entertainers. For me and Will are wrestlers, okay? You know, we don't talk about monkey porn. We don't talk about all that stuff. You know, we talk about wrestling.
Welcome to Wrestling with the Truth, the podcast for every pro wrestling fan. We've got heated debate, great guests, top 10 lists, reviews, previews, and so much more. And now here are your hosts, BC Hunter and the Nightmare, Jay Myers. All right, that's correct. This is BC Hunter joining you today along with my good buddy, the Nightmare, Jay Myers. Jay, how are you doing, my friend?
I am doing fantastic. Still a little under the weather, but trying to fight through for the love of the sport.
I appreciate you gutting things out. It's it's pretty admirable about you.
Yeah, I'll expect that danger pay in the mail this week.
I'll tell you what. I'm going to double your bonus this week and give you double the zero that we make off this podcast. So this is exciting.
Sweet.
As you know, it is November to Remember, and we kicked it off with a banger on the last episode. So we're going to try to go banger after banger, because
banger after banger after banger after banger.
We've got the fellow teammates of our guests from last week from the Smack Draw Pod. We've got Ted the Heelbilly Heel from the Heel Truth. And if you don't know his podcast, I don't know where the hell you've been living, because he is nationwide and going crazy, and he's number one in Antarctica, so you cannot beat that. Ted, how you doing?
Doing great. Glad to be here. Appreciate you guys.
Appreciate you coming on board,
you too,
sir.
Buddy.
And we also have first-time guest, but a longtime friend of the show, Mr. Will Gray from Botch Spots and Chair Shots, my favorite name of a podcast to listen to Ted pronounce over and over. Will, how you doing, my friend?
Man, I'm excellent. I appreciate you and Jay having me along for the first time and talking about some wrestling with you guys.
We appreciate you coming
thanks
on board.
Here, yeah.
And there's a particular reason why that we brought the two of you together, aside from obviously the Smack Draw connection, but it's because you're both kind of like myself, fans of the old school product as well as the new school product as well. But first love always has been old school. So I wanted to bring you on to talk about something that's really in the news lately. We're going to be talking the territories is what we're going to be doing today. And it's good timing because as we mentioned off air, we've got the Tales from the Territory series that's going on right now on Vice TV, and I think it's doing pretty well. I haven't heard the ratings on this, but I think it's doing just as good as Dark Side, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Everything that I've seen said it's all staying pretty good.
Yeah. As of tonight, I believe they're going to episode 6, which is going to talk about Polynesian pro wrestling, but so far we've had episodes on Memphis and the Andy Kaufman, Jerry Lawler battle that went on. We had the AWA, which we were mentioned was a great episode, kind of a surprise one because I figured that might be more of a boring one, but it was actually really good. The CWF episode, because that's one territory that I'm really starting to deep dive into, and it's just crazy the influence it has on the product. And then it was Stampede last week, which what'd you guys think of the Stampede episode? Have you seen it? Yes,
I haven't got to see that one yet.
I haven't seen Stampede, but from what I've read online, and this might be me just being a little jaded. Once you hear the Stu Hart story one way, it's just a different version of hearing the same story over again. Stu was one of those guys. He changed the game forever. Wrestling wouldn't have been the same without the Harts, yada, yada, yada. But at this point, like, I'm hoping, with having not seen it yet, I'm hoping that they're able to put a cool spin on it, because like, we've seen so many of the biography for Bret Hart's and the AEW or A&E biographies for Bret Hart. Like, we've all heard the Hart story so many times. I'm hoping Tales from the Territory, we're able to put a new spin on it.
I would say I did watch it, and I would say it was probably my least favorite episode, probably because I had so much knowledge on Stampede already. Being from Canada, we had that product here. We've heard the stories about Stu a million times. And I'd say the panel was a little dry, too. I mean, Brett, I love Brett. He's my favorite of all time, but he can be a little bit dry as far as his delivery on stories. Abdul the Butcher, well, he was a little dry himself. We had no class Bobby Bass, who is famous for being in here in our territory in Atlantic Grand Prix here in Nova Scotia. And he might have told maybe one story and had 10 words the whole show.
And then, all I heard was that there was a story about somebody breaking into his car and he stretched them for like 6 hours and sent them back home. That's all I heard.
That was Stu. Yeah. He did that. And Dr. D. David Schultz, who actually had some, he probably had the most flair of them all, but and had a great story on some ribs that he pulled on the boys in the
territory. Are you trying to say that Brett, in his current state, is not very charismatic and engaging in his conversation?
No, he wasn't very
Because that's what I'm saying.
He wasn't.
But you got to remember, it was Goldberg's fault.
It was I was just going to say, I mean, let's not blame Brett. It was a boot to the head. So
it's all probably, Goldberg.
Yeah, it's all
pretty
Goldberg.
Much everything was Goldberg's fault.
But ironically enough, that's what I loved about Brett when he was doing his promos back in the day, is he actually brought some seriousness to the whole.
So I was just going to say, before we get into it, like, I look back now and I have a very distinct memory of Brett's promos when I was younger. I watch them now and I'm not into it. I'm just not. He does not do it for me in today's version of promos when I watch, because his cadence was like very, very calm and slow and all this stuff. And it was masterfully done. I get that. And he was very talented and he was a really good performer in his day. But I think I was just, I don't know, maybe we'll get into it because that was a different time. But I don't look back the same way that I think I did as a kid. Because I thought he was amazing then. It was like so exciting to see him on the screen. And now I'm just like, okay, not so much. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm souring on Brett as we go here.
From somebody in the deep American South in regards to Bret Hart, I've always said he's the best technical wrestler to ever do it. And the one reason he isn't the GOAT, in my opinion, is because he was always so mediocre on the mic.
That's a great point. That's a great point.
That's the biggest reason why I put Shawn Michaels over Bret Hart, was because equally a different kind of worker in the ring, but Shawn could out-talk Bret.
Yeah.
And I think that was the biggest argument between those two coming out of that, with the screw job being 25 years this year in just a couple days, actually. Like,
yeah, that's a really good point and good take, because the inverse of that, coming from Canada, all we saw was Brett and he was like a national legend and all this stuff. So maybe in my head, he was so much more exciting and larger than life and all this stuff than really I remember that. But now I look back and I'm like, no, like I wouldn't be a fan today if he was on my screen today. Now, I would be for his in-ring work, but there's lots of reasons why we like guys for that too. But anyway, it was just the Brett thing. It has me looking back differently now. I think I would be a Shawn guy now if I really said it. I would be a Shawn guy today. I wouldn't be a Brett guy. That's sacrilege. I don't care.
I know.
I would be a Shawn guy.
Turn in your passport. Turn in your passport.
I would be a Shawn guy.
Get back your maple syrup. Come on.
100%. If that happened today, I'd be a Shawn guy.
You've always been a degenerate anyway.
I have been a degenerate at heart. Yeah, it's true.
Oh, that's why we have to all turn to Hogan. As your boy Bobby Mack would say. Eh?
And Bobby is he's the Hogan purist. That man's done no wrong in his eyes.
All I'm going to say is, woo! That's all I'm going to say.
We're going to have different takes, you and I, Ted, when it comes to these territory guys.
Well, you know, and it's funny that Ted brings that up, because when I think of the topic that we're talking about tonight, the territories, I think of the Horsemen days. I think of Mid-Atlantic. I think of World Championship Wrestling. I know WCW in the form of what it was with Ted Turner wasn't a territory, but I'm talking about World Championship Wrestling when it took over for Georgia Championship Wrestling and all that stuff. And I'm assuming that woo you're talking about is actually Earn doing it on behalf of Flair, was it? Because he's your boy, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, Arn's right there, man. You know, Arn's the guy. But, you know, if we're just going celebrity and, you know, world championships and Brett and Shawn and all that, all I got to say is Flair will just say, hold my beer. That's all I got to say. Woo!
Because I just roofied it.
Yeah.
Oh, my. The territories. That's what we're talking about this evening. And, you know, there's a kind of a interesting phenomenon in wrestling right now where there's so much back and forth between people. You got to either pick this side or that side, or it's now is the best.
Wrestling or society in general? Yeah. You
could say that. Ironically, we're on election day in the U.S. Yeah. right now, but yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Are we going to be talking about wrestling? I thought this was NASCAR.
Or Jay's favorite NASCAR is Lightning McQueen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, what was the one in Days of Thunder? That's the only one I know.
Cold Trickle, baby.
Cold Trickle. Ricky Bobby.
I get dizzy watching NASCAR, Ted. I can't do it.
Oh, my. Yeah, so we're talking about the sides that people take, and it's funny, I was having this conversation with somebody earlier today, and I don't know how you can appreciate today's wrestling without going back and appreciating the wrestling of the past. And I'm not talking you have to go back to the 1910s, you know, Hackenschmidt and all those guys, but I'm talking about pretty much the foundation that was laid from, you could argue probably from the early 80s on, like from that, I feel like for me, it goes from 82 on where you start to see wrestling really take that move upwards to what we're getting to with today's product. I realized there was some fantastic stuff during the 60s and 70s, and so some great angles during the 70s, obviously. But to me, that it just has that feeling of the early 80s is when it when the territory era kind of exploded. Although they were small time, you were still getting some national recognition. I guess that goes with the way TV went through those days as well. So what about you guys? What do you think? Like when you think of the territory days, what is there a particular time period that sticks in your mind?
Yeah. I mean, as far as me knowing what was going on, it would be the early 80s. I mean, I was watching in the late 70s, but I really didn't have a clue what it was, because the only two that I really got to see in my early childhood was Mid-Atlantic. Yep. And then, and I've mentioned this before on my podcast, but a little station brought ICW, Angelo Poffo's little promotion with the Macho Man and Lanny Poffo and some of those guys. But then, you know, that early 80s, and you know, I'm sure you're referring to, you know, also Hulkamania hits. And then with me, the biggest thing that just blew my mind was when we actually got a TV that had this little cable box, and we got this thing called the Superstation, and we were watching Georgia Championship Wrestling. And here I was seeing wrestling from Georgia. And then every now and then I would see those same guys on my Mid-Atlantic, which it was just weird. And then we got right there again in the early 80s, we got a station that started showing stuff in Texas, World Class. So I was it was just amazing to me. And then, you know, that's when I really started getting into the magazines, and it was just like a whole new world that opened up to me.
Oh yeah. I saw the tail end of the territory days, which was the part of the reason why I feel like they've always been so close to my heart, being somebody who watched the end of what was the final days, and Smoky Mountain Wrestling in the early 90s and some of the last little bits of what tried to be territory wrestling. But because I cut my teeth watching this, when I went back and rewatched it, like growing up in Nashville, we had the Jarretts and Lawler both right here in my backyard, you know, between Nashville, Memphis, Jackson, tons of rich wrestling, indie wrestling, you know, still to this day. And with Jerry and Jeff being from Hendersonville and right here in Nashville, they were kind of the gatekeepers. So you had some Mid-America guys, you had the Memphis guys, you had the JCP guys. So Nashville was kind of like, the belt buckle of the Bible Belt, so to speak. But we had so many territories all around us that we had so much coming through. You know, it was hard to grow up in the American South and not be a wrestling fan.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you guys have so much close proximity to where you were that there's just so much overflow of guys. And you can see it, like, when you go back and look at some of the footage from different territories, you're seeing the same people moving from boom to boom to boom to different spots. And then when you map it out, you realize, oh, yeah, well, that guy just moved up a state. Then he moved over a state. He's doing, like, this square around, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting that way. Jay, how about yourself? I mean, I know you talk about, like, coming into wrestling towards the end of the late 80s and you know, I think you mentioned like the Mega Powers was the first big angle that was going on, but there was still territory stuff back then. Like, were you into, and like, were you watching anything else? Like I know we had Stampede, for example, that would come on here, or AWA and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't remember anything other than the local stuff. So we had Grand Prix and we had the Stampede, I think came on every Saturday. But to me, sadly, I was not exposed. I was a WWF New York guy from the get-go, and that was all I knew. I didn't do the tapes. I didn't do the magazine. So I was, like, sheltered in that sense, which I think a lot of my generation probably was, too, because at the time I came into it, to Ted's point, Hulkamania was already full-blown exploded. It was actually WrestleMania at that point was super over already. So, yeah. Like, that was, to Vince's credit, that was the Q-tip or the rollerblade of wrestling, right? Like, that was
right.
That was the brand. They were wrestling to me. Wrestling was WWE, WWF, right? So no, sadly, I haven't been all that exposed. And as I've talked about on the show, because it's not my favorite style of pacing and sort of just work rate, and that's not taking away from the performers, it's just that's not my preference, then I haven't really gone back and explored apart from pre-WCW WCW. We've talked about that. I did like a lot of that stuff and have some sort of recollection of that. I guess it would have been World Championship Wrestling as a TV show, not the promotion, but so yeah, yeah. I really haven't been exposed to like some of these initials that you guys are throwing out here. I don't even think I was familiar with, like, JCP or off air. We're talking, I think you mentioned CJW or something like that. It's like, I haven't even heard of these things. So sadly, I'm a sheltered New York mark, I guess.
But that's okay. Like, you're bringing a unique perspective to it as well. Right. You know, because for us, like, I guess we were caught, for me, like, I devoured wrestling magazines, and that's how I found out about these places. I wasn't even getting to see them on TV or anything like that, but I knew about this. But, like, for instance, Jay, like, when would you have become, like, were you aware of the other stuff? Like say Ric Flair doing his thing over in NWA at that point?
Not really. I can remember seeing, and my dad, who was never really into wrestling, but I remember, like, a tape that I went to like record over, and it happened to be a WCW show, like, which had a very exotic feel. It was Sting and Flair, and it was like old Surfer Sting. And it was like, it looked like it's some sort of spectacle show. So I'm assuming it was like some TBS special or something like that.
Could have been Clash of Champions.
It could have been anything. I was like, what the hell is this? Like, this isn't what I know of wrestling, but, and he wasn't really that deep into it, but I just remember pulling that tape and putting it into record over it or something. I was like, what the shit is this? But so that would have been it. And then really my only real memory of starting to watch anything other is sadly the up and, like, basically the Monday Night Wars upheaval, right? So when, as that started, that was when I actually started to watch both products religiously. But yeah, before that, I had probably heard of Flair. You know what? I don't even know if I have, because, like, to me, Flair came in the Rumble and won the Rumble. That was the first time I sort of was exposed to Flair, right? That was,
wow,
that was,
okay. Yeah.
That was how I knew him. I'm trying to remember back. Now, obviously, I've seen earlier stuff, but that would probably be, and the Brainbusters were the Brainbusters to me, right? They weren't earning. Right. These guys were who they were in WWF for me. They weren't these other guys, right?
That's a pretty unique perspective.
Well, you're constantly educating me on like gimmicks that they had before. Like I just found out that Doink had I was watching some Cultaholic video and apparently had this like Grizzly Adams character or whatever in WCW for a while, even on Nitro. And I was like, where the shit did this come from? I don't know if it made Nitro, but I had only known him working as Doink. Right. So, I mean, like all of these things are still sort of, I'm discovering as we go.
Well, you're really in for a treat if you go back to Mid-South in the early 80s then, because you'll see him.
He looked great, though, in that character. Well, like, he looked really jacked up. And like he
Matt Bourne, man.
The beard and everything. Maniac. He was like a good-looking dude, man.
Yeah, for sure.
He might still be alive, so he's probably still a good-looking dude. But I don't
check
know.
Out the Rat Pack in Mid-South, and you'll get an interesting perspective of him and Hacksaw and Ted DiBiase. But
I'm constantly discovering this stuff, which is cool for me. I just, I never at the time would have known this while I was watching.
But this brings up a good point. And I don't mean for us to be dominating here, guys, but you one of the problems that you hear with people today or folks that watched during, say, the 80s, mid-80s on, early 90s, they always complained, oh, my God, Vince, he just destroyed, like, Dusty putting polka dots on him, or he destroyed Ted DiBiase, turned him into the million-dollar man. But you wouldn't have held that grudge against Vince at that time. You're just like, hey, okay, this is a guy coming in as this character, right?
No, absolutely. To me, million-dollar man is one of the most iconic characters ever. So, like, I don't think – And I didn't know any different. There was no, like, at the time, Texas Tornado was Texas Tornado. He wasn't a Von Erich. So, no preconceived anything for me. Like, so I get that perspective because I would see it now.
Yeah.
So I get the vitriol that might have been spewed at the time. But to me, it was just like, these are guys that show up on my TV that I didn't know before. So do it up.
I think that's that. Often talked about casual fan that people forget about. That's such an important piece where they don't care that Bryan Danielson is Daniel Bryan in WWE. They just want to see somebody cool wrestle.
But from my perspective, that casual fan in the early 80s that discovered this becomes a diehard fan going forward. So it's a good point. Like that. Yes. At the time I didn't know, but like that has shaped and sort of built my foundation as I went. Right. So,
yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right, guys, so I'll get back into letting you into this.
No, that's good. I mean, that whole thing, you know, like you said, was interesting because now me, I guess I was one of those, maybe at the time, a purist, where I grew up more on the Mid-Atlantic and the WCW and NWA. You know, that would just tick me off on some of that when, you know, Dusty came out and was poking. I'm like, this is not Dusty Rhodes. This is not the guy who won all these bunkhouse stampedes and had his blue jeans on and his cowboy boots and all that kind of stuff, you know? And I like the $1 million, the Ted DiBiase character, but still, man, it was hard to beat that Mid-South Ted DiBiase. I just, you know, that stuff, I love that. And even Kerry Vaughn, you know,
sorry, Dad, but especially when Ted DiBiase could have easily been NWA champion, the way he was being booked by Bill Watts, right?
Yeah, and there was rumors at a time that he may have been if he'd have stayed. But, you know, it was the same thing that Arn and Tully said. You know, they had to eventually go where the money was, where there was marketing. There was action figures. There was T-shirts, you know. Tony Schiavone has said on his podcast so many times that Jim Crockett just didn't do it with merchandising. Said if when the Rock and Roll Express hit, if they would have sold T-shirts and stuff like that, they would have made a killing. But they just didn't, you know, it was still back in that mindset of the territories, like we're talking about, that they didn't do what Vince did and expand on it, and it cost them.
Great point there. Yeah. Will, for yourself, I mean, obviously, I mean, you're of a younger generation too. Like, I think me and Ted are the older guys of this group, but you're someone who came to love this type of wrestling. But what was it that sparked you to really deep dive? Was it just a general interest, or was it like, I have to know, you know, what started this all? What was the importance of the territory system?
When I first started watching Territory Wrestling, before we went on air, I was kind of talking about my, and a shameless plug for my newsletter, but I'm talking about the indie newsletter I work for, that I started through BotchBots. And one of the things that intrigued me about indie wrestling is the tribalism between WWE and AEW right now. There's only two big brands. And you think about, if you go back far enough in the territories, you had 27 territories. There were 27 WWEs. There wasn't one Vince McMahon or one Tony Khan. You had Vince, you had the Crocketts, you had the Ganyas, you had Dusty, you had Lawler, you had the Jarretts. Like, there were 27 Vince McMahons running 27 different WWEs. And it wasn't this tribalism in a sense that they didn't care, because people who were watching WCCW in Texas didn't give a crap about what people in GCW were watching in Georgia, or the people in Memphis didn't care what was happening in New York with the WWF. I like the fact that you got into this point where wrestlers were able to come and go between each territory. Guys could be huge over faces in one place, and then as soon as you go back into the South, you're the most hated heel getting your tires slashed. You know what I mean? And that's what I liked about territory wrestling. Kayfabe was still very real then too. Stories carried themselves for years, and I'm sure we'll talk about it. Some of the Steamboat and Flares, like, these guys carried rivalries for 20 years through the territories. And I think that's what some of the stuff we don't necessarily get out of the product today, you know, is that, and I hate to say something cheesy like long-term storytelling, but in the indies, in the 70s and 80s, you didn't have the internet to continue all of this. It was all word of mouth and all tape trades and some of that stuff. So it was so hard to stay over in that period. So that's why you had the big guys that came through.
You mentioned the tape traders. Do you feel like they were kind of, how do I put this? They were almost like the early IWC, where they were kind of the ones that were pushing the exposure and all that. Yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
One of my earliest things was getting, when I was, it was probably mid 90s. The first time I was getting some of the Japanese tapes, or when you would find them at like Blockbusters or something, where you would find like these obscure like pay-per-views that you weren't going to see in my area. Cause in the American South, once again, it was WCW was pretty much WCW, and that stuff was kind of force fed to us. And then we would get WWE on their national syndicated shows or whatever. But there was so much of it in that Southern wrestling that I felt like the only way you could get exposure to West Coast or Japanese wrestling or Puerto Rico or Mexico was through tape trading. And that was still the very early internet days then, and that's how you were finding it, just message boards and stuff like that to get guys who had access to the shows.
And even before the tape trading really took off, like we were talking about the magazines, you know, the After magazines, that was all you had to find out what was going on. And then even with that, where it would come out monthly, by the time you got it, it was already a month behind, so a new story had already started, and you didn't even have a clue. You know, you might see somebody in a magazine who was in AWA, and then the next week he's in NWA, and you're like, "Oh God, I just read about him. What happened? You know what? Talking about the storytelling. What was the payoff? You know, I don't know yet. Now here he is on in my territory. So what's going on? So you know, it was." It was, the information was a lot harder to get, you know. And then I remember you'd see stuff about like the Japanese, and you would just be amazed because, you know, am I ever even going to get to watch this in real time? Unless, like I said, you find that obscure tape. I remember finding tapes at a flea market one time, you know, and it was like, oh gosh, you know, and you watch this and you're just so amazed at this stuff that's going on that you don't have a clue about. And it was just, you know, something that, like right now, we've got this information, you know, we want to know what the results are before they happen. You know, we've got spoilers, you know, it's like they tape Dark before Dynamite, and the results are already out, you know, and everybody knows. And it's like, man, how would you have lived back in the day when you had to wait a month or 2 months to find out what was going on?
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because I've never, like, how would the communication work then? Like, was there like articles or something? Like,
Well, sort of. Ted, you might be able to help with this too. A lot of times the promoters, if there were TV back then, you didn't put your big matches on TV.
Yeah.
Like, that's the whole reason the TV title became a thing, was because they didn't want the world's title to be defended on free TV. They wanted to build the stories with promos and vignettes to build the rivalry, so you would put your butt in the seat when the title was finally on the line. And I feel like that was something that we don't get now. And I say it a lot on my show about how AEW will just give you everything for free. They'll put blood and guts on TV for free. You get death matches for free. You get world title matches for free. There's nothing wrong with defending your title. But back then, the stories built to it. There was a payoff, a big match, and you never saw these guys actually put hands on each other for 4 or 6 weeks at a time until the payout for the big match.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing with that, Jay, was, like, if you really want to just see what a lot of it's back, just go on Peacock, go on the World Championship Wrestling Saturday night, starting 85 or 86. You know, it was nothing but squash matches and promos. It was like a big infomercial to get you to come to the thing. Now, every now and then, you might have an angle where they would all meet in a ring, or you might have, and like he was talking about, like Ric Flair would defend the title in the main event against Denny Brown or George South or Mike Jackson, somebody like that. You know, every now and then you might have a run in at an angle, but those were few and far between. And then the thing about the towns, you would get these main events, but it would be night after night, town after town. And unless you had a relative in that town and you could call them, they would run the same matches 5 days a week, you know. And you know, Jeff Jarrett's talked about they run the same loop. Memphis, Nashville, Evansville, and somewhere else, and a couple spot shows, and where you run that same town every week, and you were doing a long program, you couldn't give the same finish. You had to change the match up because those people had just seen it the week before. So how could you get them to come back the next week? So it was just a whole different animal. And then Arn has said on his podcast, when you were wrestling somebody every night, you would have the A match, B match, and C match. You know, nothing was rehearsed before. Heels and faces were in different locker rooms. The ref would just come and tell them to finish. And they might tell the ref, you know, so-and-so wants to know which match you want to do tonight. And he'd say, well, we're going to do our A match. Or if it was a smaller venue, well, we'll do the B match, you know. And they just knew each other's stuff so much from wrestling so much every night that it was just a completely different thing. And so, yeah, it was fun.
Well, and, you know, and me and Jay have had this argument, too, in regards to world champions and the titles. And it's come up a lot lately with Roman Reigns. And it especially came up when Brock Lesnar held the title, about the world champion not being on every show and how they have to split the titles up because they need a world champion on every show. And you think back, when you watch some of that old school stuff, the world champion wasn't wrestling on every show. The world champion might come on and do an interview on every show, just like Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan, you never saw him wrestling on Superstars of Wrestling on a Saturday. He'd come on and do a big promo. He might do two or three promos during the show or a stand-up interview. But you still saw him, but there's that mystique of not having him there all the time. And that's my biggest argument about when Seth was champion. He came out and he said right away, I'm going to defend this title every week. I'm going to be a working champion, all that, which is great. But then after a while, we almost get spoiled by too many five-star matches and things like that, where you need a little bit of, as the old saying goes, if you don't go away, how do we miss you type of thing. And right now what Roman is doing is absolutely perfect. You get to see him once a month in the ring, and the match is usually, as we've been using lately, a banger. Like, just look at what happened at Crown Jewel, right? But you're still getting the in-ring stuff where you're seeing his personality, and you see him working with Sammy and getting the Usos over and getting Solo over and getting Sammy over. So that whole group becomes important. And by proxy, you almost feel like Roman, you're getting Roman when you get that group. And so that's how you get yourself to a thousand day reign of Roman Reigns, versus by the time Seth has worked 3 months, you're like, it's time for Seth to drop the title. You know what I mean? So it's a little bit of sleight of hand, but sometimes I feel like in today's age, we just get a little bit too much of the champion. Same with Moxley. Like, we're seeing Moxley defend his title all the time. And you need to pull back a little bit and make it seem special.
And I was going to say on that. Well, sorry, go ahead, Doug.
Just real quick. My episode last week where I said AEW needs heel MJF as world champion. MJF has done just like Roman. MJF has wrestled so little that every time you see him on TV, you think it's a special event. He comes out, cuts his promo, does the vignette. But as far as actually wrestling, and he's not even their world champion, and he's still got this niche, you know, this niche thing that people are not realizing that that's how you do it. Because when he does win the belt and heel, like I said, this is why he needs to be heel, he can avoid these matches, come out like Flair did, cut the promo, talk about somebody, but I might have a match, you know, during the specials like Winter is Coming or Fighter Fest or something like that. But the rest of it's going to be on pay-per-view. So you feel like every time it's a special event. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that, Jay. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's a good take. My only line of thought was going to go, to me, a lot of the issues, like BC bring up Seth in the past, like a lot of that was just, I think, the machine that was WWE. So there's so many external factors. To me, Vince and company at that point had just considered those props anyway, and they weren't focused on it like they had been in the past where it mattered. I don't think they really gave two shits who had the belt, how many matches they wrestled before. It started to turn. Obviously, they wanted to build Roman into this machine, and that was Vince's doing and all that stuff. But I think that was just more to get the stench of past Roman off Roman and sort of build him back up to sort of be like, look at how they treated the Fiend. I mean, the Fiend was this undeniable killer in the ring, and then they just destroyed him, and he had the belt and all. It just didn't matter. So I put more focus and blame on Tony Khan's AEW, where they don't have that external pressure of Fox and USA and Peacock and all this stuff. They have full sort of power to really book it properly, and they still shove that stuff down our throat. So, like, I don't know. I'm not giving Vince and company a pass. It's just, I think it was now 2022 Triple H WWE is much different. Just look at how he's treating the IC belt and the US title, right? Total different perspective. I'm just saying Vince's sort of run of not caring about the titles can't be dismissed, because I think that soured guys like Seth or Drew even, or whatever, right? I mean, I just, Bobby Lashley, throw in anybody. Big E's title run was super unimpressive, right? So, like, I just don't think they gave a shit. And whereas Tony should be giving a shit and should be doing a better job because he doesn't have the same external factors. That's just my take on it.
Following up with the work rate thing, talking about Roman's 1,000-day reign, keeping in mind that when Flair won the title in 1983, the crazy statistic or whatever is he wrestled 300 days or whatever as champion in 1 year. Think about the fact, though, in 1983, like I said before, there were 25 different territories in 83, all under the NWA umbrella, which means he was wrestling in different territories. So it wasn't Ric Flair wrestling on WWE TV every night, five nights a week. If he worked five nights, he probably worked five different cities, five different markets, could be two or three different territories. He would be in, you know, Mid-South for 2 weeks, and then he would be in St. Louis for 2 weeks or in Portland for a month, and he's bouncing around different markets inside those territories. So looking at a 300-day work rate for Flair as a champion in 83 is very different than looking at the work rate of a Roman Reigns as champion in 2022, because they're not wrestling in the same business. It's still pro wrestling. But the fact that there's one WWE and there's not 27 different territories for him to work in, you can't see Roman five nights a week anymore, or we're going to get tired of him. Like you were saying about the the Seth Rollins thing. If we see him do open challenges every single month or every single week, then we're eventually going to get tired of seeing open challenges. It happened to Cena when he went through this phase. Now, one of the few times the crowd just kind of got tired of John Cena was when it was him pinning people in 3 minutes in squash matches for an open challenge just to put him on TV.
Yeah, that's
exactly. Yeah, and that was my point. You Flair did work that schedule, but you didn't see him on your TV. If you were in Memphis, you didn't see him on your TV except for twice a year. That was it. So it was special in that case. Same with Hogan. Like Hogan was still wrestling 300 days or 250 days a year with WWF, but you only saw him on certain programs. You saw him on Saturday Night's Main Event every time, and you saw him, you know, do a podium interview with Mean Gene on Wrestling Challenge or Superstars, or whatever, but that was it. And that's what made the difference. But Jay, you brought up a great point, like with Triple H now finally putting importance back on the IC title and the US title. You don't mind not seeing Roman defend that title as much because you're like, hell, I don't need to see Roman defend it because I get to see Gunther against Sheamus.
I don't think I've thought of it in the 4 months he's taken over. Like, I don't think I've even
– right.
It's not even once crossed my mind that we don't have a world champion on either show. But
and he's
once.
Working the same schedule as he's working with Vince, right?
Yeah.
So
no,
yeah.
Absolutely.
And
now,
that's
my only point being USA and Fox like to have a little bit of – involvement in that, and they both want a champion on their show for good reason, obviously, because that draws ratings and all that stuff. That's my only tip point around external factors that maybe AEW doesn't quite have to deal with. I'm total agreement. Just look at the World Cup. Triple H is now saying that's how Gunther's new opponent's going to be determined, is by a World Cup, like a big event, kind of big deal kind of tournament, just to crown a number one contender. Remember the days where we just used to get, if you pin the guy, you get a title match. Like I don't think we've had that once in Triple H's regime here. Mm-hmm. It's been contender matches or triple threat matches to decide a number one contender and all that stuff. So I agree with everybody's take. My only point was, I think it just became lazy for a while with Vince and company where they just didn't give a shit about the belts.
Well, see, that was the other thing when we were talking about like Flair and all these different towns and even, you know, whichever territory, the house show loot, you know, they weren't getting televised. And like I said, without internet, unless you knew somebody in that town that was a wrestling fan that was going to call you. And then that's where I've heard these guys talk about that every now and then you change the title. Mm-hmm. On one of these house shows that wasn't a big event or a main thing, so that people would think, man, maybe the title's going to change tonight.
I got to go to this show.
It changed in Des Moines, Iowa, or somewhere like that, you know, or where Topeka, Kansas, or wherever, so that it could. And excuse me. And that's why, even though, you know, Flair lost the title a lot, and some of those reigns that they had were short back then, sometimes it was because not everybody even knew that it happened, you know, because, you know, we were talking about the Von Erichs. You know, I remember, you know, reading, you know, they were going to do the David Von Erich Memorial down there, and you know, Kerry finally won the belt, and I didn't get to see the show. I read about it in the magazine, but like I was saying earlier, by the time I read the magazine, he'd already dropped it back. You know, Kerry wasn't even world champion again. Yeah. You know, he'd already dropped it, and I didn't know. And it was like one of those things that it kept it fresh because people didn't know. And like I said, we weren't exposed. We don't have, you know, 400 channels and YouTube and Twitter and all this other stuff. So it did, I think, just the nature of the beast, it was fresher back then, even if the title reign was long or if it was short, because we just didn't have a clue. We were living in the Stone Age, you know. It was back in the day.
It's funny, Ted, you bring that up, because I'd like to get you your take and Will's take, because, like, that's been my argument, as we've had on this show many times, that you can't do kayfabe in 2022 because of all the things you just referenced. And it's not because it's not a cool idea or that I hate the idea. It's because it's not realistic to assume you could pull it off in 2022. I just don't think it's fair to the talent. BC will argue that there's ways you could do it, but I just don't think it's fair to the talent to have to do all of those hoops that they would have to do just for a smidge of kayfabe to be still relevant. Like that all of those things you just mentioned are why it's not the same in 2022 as it was in 1985 or whatever to do some of the things that you could do then.
And speaking on the trading belt things and going back and forth, 1976, Wahoo McDaniels, Ric Flair, JCP, Jim Crockett Promotions, they traded the Mid-Atlantic title like 8 times that year because they were in this ridiculous feud that was going back and forth. And like Ted was saying with some of these house show tours, it was that frequent where Flair might have it for 30 days. And then when they move to a different market, you know, Wahoo will pick it up because he's more over. And they traded the belts like 7 or 8 times in one calendar year just because the story allowed it to happen. And it was on the fly, too. There were some nights where they would be like, okay, like, let's give it back to Wahoo and Flair will get it in 2 days when we get back to Charlotte. You know, like, just because it was that easy and you didn't have to worry about the fans as much. Yeah. But the whole protected the belt and people having 1,000-day reigns, like, outside of your Brunos and some of your WWF guys, like WWWF guys, there weren't a lot of 1,000-day reigns as the NWA champion because every territory wanted a shot at having their boy be the number one guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, there's the Bruno factor as well. Like Bruno did not have to do the touring that Ric Flair had to do or Jack Briscoe or whoever had the title at that time. It wasn't even close to that. Or same with Hogan. He didn't have to do the same amount of towns as Flair. It's funny you mentioned about the trading of the titles. I know I was watching something from 82 from Mid-Atlantic, and I think it wasn't the Mid-Atlantic. I think it might have been maybe either a national title or the U.S. title. But in a 3-week span, I remember watching it. Joe LeDuc had the title, then Paul Jones had the title, and then it was Jack Briscoe had the title, then went back to like Paul Jones. And 3 of the 4 title changes that happened on cards, like at host shows and stuff like that, right? It's just like, if you were trying to walk into it and keep track, but you'd just be like, what the hell is going on here? But it's just kind of the thing with back then, like in the territories, you had to have those hot potato things just to keep the audience going. I just watched, man, I just stumbled onto it. And I got to thank our boy, Big Mike, the host from Armstrong Avenue, because I just stumbled onto Southeast Championship Wrestling. And it's from 85 that I'm watchers. No, it's not 85. It's from 83, I think. Terry Taylor, a young Terry Taylor. Like, here's another thing. If you only know Terry Taylor as the Red Rooster, man,
You missed out.
Checkmate.
Yeah, exactly. If you watch the progression of Terry Taylor from Southeast to Mid-Atlantic and to Mid-South, and see what a trajectory he is on, you're sitting there going, how did he not win the NWA title? Because he was just pegged to be a star. But for instance, in this, it was Terry Taylor wins the Southeast title off of Kamala, basically. He was Big Daddy Harris at that point or something like that. The next show, Dutch Mantel and him are going at it, and he ends up getting challenged by Dennis Condrey for the title. He's lost the Mid-Atlantic or the Southeast heavyweight title within 2 days of winning it, right? But that's what they would do just because it got the fans into it and it got the angles over with stuff like that. And for some reason, it didn't seem to make the titles feel unimportant. It actually seemed to make them feel more important and also had that element of surprise that they could change at any time.
Yeah. And Jay, you were talking about the keeping the kayfabe. One thing they also had to do back then, and I know Arn's talked about this, where a lot of these shows were taped weeks in advance. So when they would do a promo, they had to, you know, have the knowledge of, okay, what happened? This show isn't going to be shown for 2 weeks. So I've got to cut this promo. Even though I've won the belt, I've got to pretend like I haven't won the belt and I'm still chasing it. And he said it was sometimes hard to keep track, and especially what market, because one market, it might be shown in syndication, it might be a month out. Right. But those people that are getting those promos, so, you know, I guess that was something that they had to deal with to keep kayfabe and to remember the continuity of the story and stuff like that. So, you know, I've said before, and I know I've heard your all show, and we've talked about the new kayfabe is just what they can try to do on social media. And, you know, and we're trying to figure out, is it a work? Is it a shoot? You know, all this stuff. And then it gets confusing. And I know it can be taxing on them to try to stay in character, or, you know, it's I'm a heel and a villain in the ring. But here's my Instagram and here's my cute puppies. Here's my cat, you know, that kind of stuff. Or even at the meet and greets, because, you know, I like the House of Black, you know, Malachi and Brody King. I mean, they just look like you do not want to walk down a dark alley and meet them. But when I met Malachi Black at a meet and greet last year, he's the nicest guy ever. You know, he was just so nice. Yeah. You know, and you're sitting there thinking, because, you know, it's the same thing. Now, another person who doesn't get enough credit for keeping in character at meet and greets and stuff like that, that I saw, I didn't actually go up to the table, but is Danhausen. He's the same in person as he is on TV. He doesn't change. You might not like him, but I will say that he stays in character 24/7, I'd say.
Very evil 24/7.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so I can sense that we could easily have a part two, part three, part four of this, because we could talk about some of the stories from it. I feel like we're just grazing on the territory thing, but I want to take a different angle on this. So let's say that we're going to convince old Jay here that you got to go check this stuff out. And we're going to tell you what angles that you should go check out. So I want each of us to maybe provide Jay with some of the best angles that we could possibly get him to convince to watch this stuff, maybe, and get a history lesson. You know, for me, like what we talked about earlier, it felt like the early 80s is when this really took off. We talked about Hulkamania starting, and not in WWF, it started in AWA, and really it started with
Gasp! Rocky. You lie.
It started with Rocky III is where it started, right? With that stuff. But, you know, I also think of, for some reason, what sticks in my head is the Hulkamania thing, the Starrcade, the early Starrcade stuff with Flair going for the gold. Tommy Rich, for some reason, always sticks in my head. That 1 week friggin' title reign, the most amazing 1 week title reign in the history. And like you mentioned, Ted, like, I think there's maybe 400,000 people that actually experienced that, because everybody else saw it in a magazine 2 months after it actually happened. But that sticks in my head. Like, you did a Patreon on the last Battle of Atlanta. I mean, that was just insanity, the you know, that kind of stuff. But what kind of angles would you suggest if Jay's going to pick? And then we'll talk about maybe our favorite territory that we should go check out. But what angles would you say, you know, this is the one that I know you may not like this stuff, but you got to check it out because it's just going to blow your socks off.
For me, Jay, again, WCW 1986. There was so many angles in that 1 year. You had the Road Warriors against the Russians in a bunch of Russian chain matches. You had Nikita against Magnum, best of seven series. You had Dusty and Magnum against the Horsemen. You had the Midnight Express against Magnum, Dusty, and Baby Doll. You had Paul Jones against Jimmy Valiant, hair versus hair. I mean, just that whole year had so many great angles and stories, and it was just, they all interwove. It was just like a big web. And I'll go ahead and throw this out here. 1986 was not only one of my favorite years, one of my most memorable years, Great American Bash. They went 14 cities. I actually got to go to Johnson City, Tennessee. I got to see the Russian chain match. The Road Warriors beat the Russians. Arn and Tully against the Rock and Roll Express in a double count out. Then there was Magnum, Dusty, and Baby Doll against Midnight Express and Jim Cornette. So I had a little intergender match back in the 80s, you know. And then Ric Flair and Ronnie Garvin in a steel cage in the main event. And back then, that whole year of 86, all those parts could change. For 2 weeks, Magnum could be against Nikita. Then for 2 weeks, Magnum would be with Dusty against the Midnight Express. Then for 2 weeks, the Midnight Express against the Rock and Roll Express. And then throw the Horsemen in there against them all. And to me, 86 was my golden year of professional wrestling.
All right. Duly noted. Sure, I do remember watching something on the Great American Bash because it was like a touring show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like they had it in stadiums and stuff too. I remember watching something like that.
Yeah, and had concerts beforehand, yeah. Had George Jones and David Allan Cole.
David Allan Cole.
People like that.
They did. And during that tour, some of the things they did was going off of what Ted was speaking earlier in the episode about A match, B match, C match. During that Great American Bash tour, because they did so many shows, they built storylines inside the live tour while it was happening, which was super cool because when you got to see it over and over again, it was kind of like seeing the Grateful Dead. You didn't see the same show every night, even though it was the Great American Bash tour. Yeah. You know what I mean? So if you saw it two or three times on that same tour, it was a different show.
Didn't Flair have 16 different title defenses during that tour? And like most of them went an hour.
14. Yes. 14. Yeah. And about every one of them was 30 to 60 minutes. Yeah.
And we're talking about people that you wouldn't expect, like Road Warrior Hawk going half an hour with him and you know, Ricky Morton going a full hour and all that stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Will. Go ahead, man.
No. That's what I love about this kind of conversation is because I can say something and it'll make Ted think of something, which will make you think of something, and it just kind of bounces around. If I was going to tell somebody, though, which area of territory wrestling I was going to suggest for Jay, it's not really one specific angle. It's a series from 1981 to 1984, and that's Flair's first title victory over Dusty through roughly that 84-85 range, because when you watch Flair's work over that time, you think of Dusty Rhodes, you think of Harley Race, Carlos Colon, you think of him going through steel cage matches, all the stuff he did, all the works when I was talking about working 300 days, you got Kerry Von Erich in there, like just the list of people he worked with over this 2 or 3 or 4 year period is just a who's who. That's not mentioning, you know, Steamboat, like so many other guys that I could probably think of him on the fly, but like just the amount of people and talent he wrestled inside of that 3 year period, changing titles and dropping titles, the conspiracy and drama inside of Puerto Rico where Carlos Colon beat him for the title, then lost it 2 days later, you know, and it's never been approved as an official, like there's so much drama and angles inside of that 3 year run for Flair that if you want a taste of what true territory wrestling was like, from 81 to 84, roughly, watching Flair go back and forth with all these guys for that NWA World's title was what it was about, because it'll be in one territory, then it'll be somewhere else, and all the time centered around the 10 pounds of gold.
Sweet.
That's a great call. Great call. For me, it's funny, Ted. I agree. Like, I look at 86 as probably my golden year of wrestling, too, both from I wasn't even able to watch NWA, but I read so much about the magazines that I devoured it that I felt like it was there, you know, through that whole thing. And I get highlights of different things as well, like some tapes and stuff like that. And then WWF, I love WWF in 86. I mean, you had Hulkamania probably at its peak at that time. I know everybody thinks it's WrestleMania 3, but 86 was a crazy year. You had Saturday Night's Main Event, which was popping off. You had some great, like you had the Savage Steamboat angle that started in 86. You know, you had the British Bulldogs revolutioning the WWF tag team scene and the Hart Foundation coming onto the scene as well. You just had, I mean, they were just stacked with the main eventers at that time. But yeah, 86, like I just remember talk about an angle to check out. Watch just the feud with Flair and Ricky Morton and watch how much of a star Ricky Morton becomes and how you can see a tag team wrestler that's about to break out and be the Shawn Michaels of that group. But Ricky, I think Ricky just didn't want to be the solo guy. He wanted to be with Robert Gibson, but look at how over the Rock and Roll Express was during that time. You know, look at the tag team stuff that was going on. The I Quit match with Tully and Magnum during that time. The Best of Seven series. I remember that too. That was fantastic. Memphis Wrestling. Go check out Memphis Wrestling, like back from the early 80s. You'd think that they have crazy angles now with monsters and all this stuff. Jerry Lawler had booked some of the craziest angles ever, like where he'd bring in some movie monster to be his opponent for 3 weeks, and then he'd come over. Talk about a guy that was over, too, Jerry Lawler. You want an appreciation for somebody being over where they're working every night of the week at the the Memphis Coliseum or whatever the heck it was called. I forget. But anyways, like this.
And he also didn't he hold a ridiculous title? I'm looking it up real quick on the fly. He held the Mid-America Championship like 58 times.
It's just a record. And he'd intentionally do that because he would drop it so they had an angle to do for the next match, right?
Well, he actually did that with Taker as the AWA Southern Heavyweight title 58 times. He did it with Taker when he was Texas Red. He came in with Texas Red, and it was the whole Jerry Lawler wants to beat the Giant. So what he'll do is he'll have a Giant come into the territory, beat the absolute piss out of him, and then over the next 4 or 6 weeks, he's building back up to reclaiming his title. And he does it almost clockwork. You knew exactly what Lawler was going to do. This new guy was going to come in and beat the crap out of him. It was like watching a Rocky movie in real time, only spread out over like 4 weeks.
I remember seeing like Sid as Lord Humongous back then, right? You know, that was the first time you ever saw Sid.
Skyscrapers, right?
And thinking this guy is amazing. I didn't know who he was, but he was amazing. Another thing. Go ahead, Ted.
Just real quick on Memphis, and you were talking about ratings. When Memphis was at its peak in the Memphis Nashville area, they said on Saturday morning they were getting a 7 out of 10 share. 7 out of every 10 televisions were tuned in to the wrestling show down there, and it went on for years. So. You know, I don't know how big the market was, but still, when you got 7 out of every 10 TVs in that area on Saturday, they were watching Memphis Championship Wrestling. That's some pretty good ratings.
Was the demo, though? Come on, what was the demo?
I don't know. But
so the King name wasn't just a moniker then. He was literally the King.
He was.
And see, Jerry Jarrett, back then, a lot of them had to pay to be on the TV show because that was basically what it was, an infomercial. They would have to pay the TV station. They would get a small cut of the ad revenue. And they said Jerry Jarrett was one of the first ones to broker a deal where the TV station paid him. Mm-hmm. That's the innovation. And even before Vince and all these cable right deals and all that, it was done by Jerry Jarrett.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll add a couple more things too. Georgia Championship Wrestling from like 82 when Piper was there doing the commentary and stuff like that. You want to see where MJF is copying off of? There's your guy right there. And talk about a guy that didn't need to wrestle. How many times did you see Piper wrestle? Really? He didn't need a title or anything like that. That's exactly what you were talking about with MJF, Ted. And then finally go watch WCCW, the world class stuff from 1982. When the Von Erichs and the Freebirds rivalry kick off, I mean,
yes,
you want to see dedicated fans. Number one, the fans are just insane for the Von Erichs, insane. And then when that angle kicks off, it's a Christmas night of 82 with the steel cage match with the Freebirds. It's just, that's a territory that just caught fire back then. And it's too bad about all the tragedy. We talked about that before that happened with the Von Erichs, but man, that is a great territory to watch if you want to see some old school stuff. And also, there was a lot of stiff matches during that time, too, with those guys.
And you're talking about that Christmas match that started off with the Von Erichs and the Freebirds. Again, Flair is there defending the title. And and the whole thing really wasn't about Flair. You know, the people came because this is Kerry's chance. But it turned into the Freebirds turning on him. And started one of the biggest feuds in wrestling history where, like I said, people were going to riot. they would, you know, they did not like the Freebirds because the Von Erichs were milk and cookies and Jesus and all America. You know, it was, they did not like the Freebirds.
Yeah, that is 100% accurate there. What was I going to say about that too? Oh, just the weaving of the flair thing right into all these. That's the beauty of the NWA back then. It's ironic. What we haven't mentioned is don't go check out early 80s WWF because it was absolutely horrible at that time. There's just, man, it really was. But if I can pull one nugget from the early 80s that I've always sworn by is, if you're going to check out anything, watch Don Morocco's work in the WWF in the early 80s. Like, he was the MVP of the WWF prior to Hogan coming there. I mean, his work back then, like, on the mic was amazing. In the ring was amazing. Some of the angles that he did with some of the guys, yeah, that's some pretty cool stuff there as well. But
And he worked solid all the way into the late 80s, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, looking all the way into the SummerSlams and stuff, 87, 88, 89, Don Morocco was still on those cards, you know? He was the Rock Don Morocco by that point, you know? Like, but he
was. But if you watch the early stuff, it's just two different people, and he's just amazing. Like, it's such a good heel. Such a good heel. Just some of the stuff he did. And just crossing the line beyond belief with some of the stuff he did in the interviews, too. But yeah. All right.
And see, I remember that snooker was in Mid-Atlantic in NWA. Yep. Then he goes up north. And then, you know, for us to see somebody come off the top of the cage, you know, we just thought, oh, my God, nobody will ever do this again. And now it's Hurricane Rana's and everything else off the top of a cage. And, you know, Jeff Hardy goes up on ledges and buildings and, you know, it's just, we'll just jump off of it. So it's like, okay.
Flair won the world title in 1983 with a crossbody off the top rope. Think about that. Think about what we see in today's wrestling, and Flair pinned Harley Race for the 1-2-3 with a crossbody off the top rope.
Was that his one and only successful top rope dive? Or is that,
Probably.
All right, guys, I got one more question for you, then we'll get out of here. If just very quickly, if you could transport yourself to one territory at one time so you could go relive it again, where would you go?
I want to go to Memphis. With it being in my backyard, I would love to be able to have lived the Lawler and Jarrett days. And being, like I said, I got to see the tail end of it, but I would have loved to have seen Jerry Jarrett be the gatekeeper in Nashville. Kind of like what you guys were saying, like if a different territory wanted to come work Nashville, you had to pay Jerry, you had to book his boys, you had to do it all. If you wanted to book anywhere in Nashville, you had to go through him. And I wish I could have been there, you know, born maybe 10 years earlier than what I was. So I could have been that 13, 14, 15 year old kid living Memphis wrestling then, not at the very end of it. Seeing, you know, the tail end come through. I would have loved to have been able to have been there for that part. The easy pick would have been Jim Crockett Promotions. But I think being a Tennessean, being able to live and watch Memphis wrestling live would have been it for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ted?
Yeah, I'm going back to my heyday. I'm going back to JCP. If I knew what I knew now, you know, I would have been at those studio tapings. I would have went to more live events and probably would have you know, moved down to Charlotte back then, just told mom and dad, hey, I'll see you whenever, you know.
So wait, a Tennessean picked Memphis wrestling and a guy from Carolina picked Jim Crockett Promotions. Big surprise there, right?
I guess I gotta pick Atlanta Grand Prix then. But I'm sorry, I'm gonna go. My easy answer, again, same thing. I'd go JCP, right? I go Jim Crockett, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm going to go World Class 82 on. As long as I don't know about the Von Erich tragedies that were going to happen, I want to relive that because there's not just the Von Erichs. There's like Gino Hernandez, and there's, you know, Chris Adams and all these people. There's just some phenomenal stuff that went on. And honestly, they if the tragedies didn't happen, because they actually did have syndication and they did have the satellite TV, they were hitting a lot of homes. They were on the verge of maybe really, if not challenging WWF, they were challenging JCP for that second place. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, Jay, I'm going to put you on the spot here, but is there anything that, like, obviously, you know, now compared to what you knew then, is there anything that you wish you would, you know, got a chance to experience, even if it was like something like WWF wise?
No, I think to me, it would have been just kind of immersing myself at, again, it's a different me then, because I'm more just a fan of pro wrestling now, but just being immersed in all of the pro wrestling would have been cool. But one question I have for you three is, how come I haven't heard Florida Championship Wrestling talked about one time?
We haven't even gotten a chance to. That's why I say we need.
Yeah, we haven't even got to that.
Yeah, yeah. That was supposed to be a good
conversation.
But that was a good territory, was it not?
Yeah, it was a great territory. Yeah, it was a great territory.
I think me and you might have to do a separate episode on Florida, man, because like that's Dusty's bread and butter. Yeah. Eddie Graham, which really.
But that was the Briscoes too, right?
Yeah, the Briscoes were down there. Yeah. Kevin Sullivan, man.
Kevin Sullivan stuff.
Oh boy!
We touched on Black Saturday, the McMahon buyout when he came in and bought out 80% of the territories.
And Barry Windham, when he was the Florida state champion, Flair went down there again that mid-80s, and they had a match on TV, and it went 60 minutes. And at the time, Dave Meltzer said it was the best 60 minutes of wrestling he'd ever seen in his life.
Outside of the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah, outside of Tokyo Dome.
Oh man, yeah, you're right, Jay. Like,
and I don't know anything really of it. I remember hearing that name several times for
Championship Wrestling from Florida. Yeah, that's what you want to look that up on YouTube. There's some good video from them, like good quality video, as opposed to some of these ones that you watch are just, they're obviously on somebody's VCR and it's like hard. It's hard to watch. That's the other problem with some of this older stuff, is it's just not quality video, but. For some reason, Championship Wrestling from Florida has some great video out there. I definitely recommend it. And just if you can watch Kevin Sullivan stuff, like there's some insanity that guy was doing. And they were ahead of their time, too. Like for such an old school promoter, they came up with some really crazy angles. Dusty, that's where he got his angles that he brought on to JCP. Like say Eddie Graham was somebody that was known as one of the best Finnish guys in the business. Probably everybody thinks of like Pat Patterson, but literally they tell stories about how he would, you know, if you missed a drop kick in the finish, he'd pick it out and you know, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of great stuff from that. And I think there's a separate episode we'll have to get you guys back and we'll talk a little bit about
we'll do it again.
Yeah. The Florida side of things for sure. Anyways, guys, I want to say thank you very much for your contribution here. This has been fantastic. And Jay, I appreciate your patience. This one was more to indulge me with this old school talk here. But I do appreciate you being kind enough to allow that to happen. So before we get out of here, I'm going to give you both a chance to give your plugs, just plug away about your shows and where everybody can find you. Ted, you want to lead us off?
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at Hillbilly Heel. That's the only social media. There are some outdoor decor, some recipes, and a few other little household items on Pinterest that claim they're me, but they're not. You can find my podcast, The Heel Truth, on anywhere you get your audio listening pleasure, Apple, Spotify, iHeart, Google, all that good stuff. I'm also part of the Smack Draw channel. They've got the YouTube, they've got the Twitch. As I said, we got the Patreon where I do exclusive episodes. Last month, I did as we were talking about, Magnum and Tully, I Quit match. Buzz Sawyer and Tommy Rich in the last Battle of Atlanta, which that cage was the inspiration for Hell in a Cell. You can check me out there and just all the different, like I said, podcast platforms. And as we said, if you can, we appreciate it if you could go over on the Apple. And even if you don't listen to it normally on Apple, just borrow your significant other's phone or tablet or your children or whoever, your cousin, whoever has an Apple device, and hit that little 5-star rating. Give me a 5-star review, and I like to read those reviews out on the air, and we appreciate it. And number one in Antarctica still.
And number one in our hearts, because Ted truly is the most supportive podcaster out there and most supportive guy on Twitter for podcasts. He does listen to these episodes. He does comment on them. He does give you feedback. So, yeah, let's go support our friend Ted the Hillbilly Heel. Thanks, Ted. And Mr. Will Gray, let's hear your stuff.
I am the Will Graham, the host and writer for Botch Bots and Chair Shots. We are a three-man team made up of myself, Bobby Mack, the Yellow Shoe Guy, and the boss babe, Miss Allison Siegel. I said babe because I'm not sure if I can cuss on your show or not.
Did you not listen to our last episode with your teammates there?
The boss bitch.
Yeah, that monkey porn.
We do everything wrestling related. We do things from the history of the strap, where we talk about specific time periods and histories for title belts. We talk about very finite discussions in pro wrestling. So if you want to hear about territory wrestling from 1976 to 1986, we might be a good pick. If you want to hear about, you know, the world title from 1991 to 1998, you know, stuff like that. Very, very finite discussions inside the world of pro wrestling. We are also the powering body behind the Indie Wrestling Gazette, which is my newsletter, where it comes out roughly 2 times a month right now, and it's focused towards venues, promotions, indie stars, things that all encompasses the indie revolution that is happening right now. Like Ted said, you can find us anywhere on the internet under the Smacked Raw Podcast Network umbrella or at Botch Bots and Share Shots.
Nice. And I thought we should also mention you got some really good news this week too, as well, from a health standpoint.
I did. This past Wednesday, I had my last blood draw done. I have a squeaky clean bill of health for the first time in 2 years, and they decided it was a good time to rip that chemo port out of my chest. So for the first time in 2 years, I'm free of all peripherals from IVs and picks and ports. I am just a normal ass human being now.
Oh, that's awesome news. Awesome news, Will. Now you have no excuses for being an asshole, right?
No, I'm just a normal asshole.
Can't blame the drugs anymore. Well, this has been fantastic. Jay, anything that you wanted to add before we get going here, my friend?
No, I just appreciate the wealth of knowledge in the virtual room here. It's impressive as shit. And if people haven't clued in now, these fine gentlemen know what they're talking about. So so respect, mad respect. I'm still not going to watch any of that stuff, even though I love the recommendations, but I'm just being honest. So, ain't nobody got time for that.
The steel cage match from 1982 is an interesting Jay.
Oh, come on.
I mean, I might check out the Inspiration to Hell and Cell. That's piqued my interest, but.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Bloody is all ghetto.
And I just want to say one last thing, from your last week's episode, as you had, Kyle and Arian, and they may be more humorous, they may be more funny, but they are definitely sports entertainers. For me and Will are wrestlers, okay?
I guess we're going to talk about wrestling category too.
I need a clip of that. As soon as that happens,
you know, and I don't know if you heard the one thing. You know, we don't talk about monkey porn. We don't talk about all that stuff. You know, we talk about wrestling. Okay, so you know that's
Ted,
what you want.
I think you just booked a future future Super Pod show, pro wrestlers versus sports entertainers pods. I think. I think that's what we're gonna have to do.
I think we have to do a War Games match here.
I think we do.
It's Ted versus RN. Fitting.
No, it's me, you, and Ted against RNJ and Ty.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it. War Games awesome. Coming up. We got Survivor Series. Let's do it.
We need a clip of Regal doing War Games. Oh man. Oh, that's a nice way to end it. I do enjoy that. As for us, go at WWTT Pod, wherever you can find
you know
anything.
It. If you don't know it by now, you don't know it.
Yeah. Give us a 5-star review for God's sake. Get us on another chart somewhere and go follow our YouTube channel. Go subscribe now, please. So we can get that community tab. Anyways, I will leave it on that note. And I thank you very much, everybody who's tuned in. I thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. Stay tuned for another exciting episode in our November to Remember. And for Ted the Hillbilly Heel and the Wheel Gray and Jay Myers, I am BC Hunter saying we are out of here.
Dust it, baby. That's all I got.
If you weed.
If you weed.